Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. How are you, my friends? I hope you're well. This is episode 51. I was so busy working on my getting my mini episode out last week about the autonomic nervous system. Hope you enjoyed it. That I completely missed that it was episode 50. So I'll take a couple seconds here to celebrate this milestone. For the early adopters of the show back to the beginning of 2017, I want to give a sincere thank you, many of whom are colleagues, family, and friends. You all gave me some very valuable feedback and support and kept me motivated to push this thing forward. And also because you shared episodes, this show is now being listened to in more than 25 countries. So thank you so much. And, you know, looking back over the 40 plus unique voices I think I've recorded here, I feel fortunate that I've been given this opportunity to spend time with each guest, all of us with busy lives and careers, and it just doesn't get to happen very often. It's also been an incredible thing to spend, you know, time through the edits of these conversations and to write for them. With each one, I get excited to release it as if it's my new favorite thing in the world. So I hope you feel that way about each of them as they come out as well. And this conversation you're about to hear with Dr. Bill Manahan, one of the most beloved figures in the world of health, is no exception. A great time we had together doing this one. That'll be up in just a minute. If this is your first time listening to the show, I want to welcome you. Highway to Health is a place for you to explore and create your own blueprint for health and well-being. Having worked in integrative health for more than 20 years, I'm acutely aware of how all aspects of our world come to have an effect on our health and our communities. And it is my hope that through the content and conversations here on the podcast, you might be able to navigate it with greater ease, make more informed decisions, and be able to be more present and engaged with your life in the way that you'd like to. I want to say a quick thank you to the new supporters of the podcast and to everyone who has donated to the development of this project. Each episode takes about 10 hours to produce, so 51 episodes in, you can imagine the kind of effort, attention, and resources this takes. If you feel like this has been a valuable part of your life, or you've been influenced or inspired or informed in any way by this project, would you please consider becoming a supporter? It's so easy to pledge your support, and you can donate for as little as $1 a month. Go to patreon.com/highwaytohealth. If you listen every week, $5 to $10 a month ensures that we can keep putting these episodes out regularly and develop new content for you. And I promise to keep bringing you the same amazing guests and resource that you've been getting here for the past 3 years. So I have a comment that came up here that I wanted to share with you because I feel like it speaks to the theme of celebrating milestones. I happen to know who made this comment, but I'll share it anyway. And the comment was simply, "Dude, do you realize how good your podcast is?" My immediate response was to say thank you, and also no. I don't really spend any headspace judging what I'm doing here. If anything, I always feel like that whatever I'm doing is not enough. And I share this because this is all too common a feeling in most of us. Personally, I spend most of my headspace thinking about what I can do better and what's beyond the horizon. And I don't think there's anything wrong with this per se, but the gratitude piece of this is to celebrate the milestones when they come. Hit pause for a day and sit with this time period and what this time period has given you. It's kind of a chapter of sorts. And what's really important here is the effort and the connections that we make in this process. And we are always in process. So thank you for waking me up with this comment. And I'm taking stock of what it is I'm getting from this process. And if you like what I'm doing, that's great. So thank you. If you'd like to become more engaged with the happenings around this podcast, you can also check out the highwaytohealthpodcast.com website, now up and running, or our Instagram and Facebook pages for Highway to Health Podcast. And if you have a guest that you think I should have a conversation with, you can shoot me an email through the contact form on the website. So my guest for today is Bill Manahan. And if you're a medical, integrative, or holistic practitioner in Minneapolis or St. Paul, you've most likely heard of him or met him at some point. He charters the Minneapolis Holistic Medical Group, and he's done it for over 30 years. And he tells me the story of its beginnings here in the conversation. He comes from a tradition in the Midwest that saw medicine as a calling, as a vocation, and what could be considered, you know, almost like a spiritual practice. I happen to be of the same ilk, and when I met Bill for lunch about 6 months ago, I felt like I had really met a kindred spirit. turns out that he's cultivated a group of close to 1,000 of us here in the Twin Cities. So it was nice to know that he wasn't the only one out there. And being connected to a larger national organization of holistic practitioners through this group, which Bill has been connecting with for the better part of his career. And what's most striking about him is his endless kindness and curiosity, even after 40 years and into retirement. He has an incredibly intuitive sense of what's happening in medicine and where it's going. He's a true bridge builder in medicine, and his insight is so incredibly valuable, I think, to understand where we've come from and the challenges that we are facing in health as practitioners in various fields. Please enjoy my conversation with Bill Manahan. Did you grow up in Mankato? I forget where you're
Medelia,
from.
Medelia, a town 20 miles away.
Medelia, okay.
A town of 2,000. And then eventually came back there and practiced for 30 years.
You were in Mankato the whole time?
For the 30 years, yeah.
Is that right? You had started a place that's still going down there, right?
I started Open Door Health Center, which is a clinic for the underserved and uninsured.
That's right. And that covers sort of all facets of health too, right? You do sort of general.
Well, it's an interesting story. I actually started the Wellness Center of Minnesota in 1982, which was a holistic center with different types of practitioners practicing together: physical therapist, a nurse practitioner, a nurse mental health therapist, a biofeedback therapist, a naturopath. Helen Healy was coming down one day a week. That was 1982. By 1988 or so, we just realized we couldn't make any money because insurance wouldn't reimburse us.
Yeah.
And it was a time where people weren't ready to pay money in rural Minnesota for services, even if they were healthy. So I transformed it into I just changed the name and called it Open Door Health Center, made it a free clinic for the underserved and uninsured.
Huh. How did you raise funding for that?
Mainly, I just did it for nothing. I did it a couple, you know, I started out with a half a day a week, then 2 half days, Wednesday afternoon, my day off, and Saturday morning. And then I got a nurse who was volunteering, and we volunteered for a couple of years just giving our services. I got a podiatrist to give us his building free because he was off on Wednesday afternoon and Saturday. So we got the free building. And then we kept track of who came there, and about 40% of them would have gone to the ER,
yeah.
And so none of them would have paid. So then we figured out. I went to the ER, found out what the costs were, and then I went to the hospital and said, "We saved you $140,000 this last year."
They got interested.
So they got interested, and they gave us $30,000 for 2 years. And, you know, just sort of that way, we just sort of gradually got a little money. And then the orthopedic clinic had an empty space that they were going into enlarging and had an empty. And they were friends with the orthopods. So they gave us that space. And then we started. And then I got a couple of nurses to work there more often. And so eventually it just, you know, one by one until we see 10,000 people a year there.
Yeah.
And it's big.
So did your private practice end up morphing into that space, or were you outside of that working for money somewhere else?
I kept a private practice that I had.
And you did some education work too, if I'm not mistaken, right? At Mayo, or did some mentoring or some kind of thing?
Yeah, from 1973 till about 1980 or 90. I was on the clinical faculty of Mayo, called a clinical associate, clinical professor.
Yeah.
Because when Mayo started their medical school in the early 70s, they didn't have any family doctors at Mayo.
Yeah.
So they came to me, and another doctor in Mapleton and I would drive down there every Wednesday on our day off and help them set up the Department of Family Medicine. So I got really involved with their family medicine at Mayo. And then over the years, I had over 80 medical students and residents come to me from Mayo to work with me for anywhere from 1 week to 4 weeks. So I did a lot of teaching, but it was in my office most of the time.
What was the impetus to start this Minnesota Holistic Medical Group?
totally selfish. It's that
this I 35 years ago or what? How long?
No,
was
it was
then?
1989. So it's been 30 years.
30 years.
Yeah, 30 years ago. It's an interesting story, and it's how sometimes just taking care of oneself and being selfish is a really good thing.
Right, right.
But I was involved in the 80s in the national holistic group called the American Holistic Medical Association. I was on the board starting in maybe 82, 83, and then I became president in 1990.
Okay.
It's a two-year term. So from about 85 on, I was going to these board meetings every 3 months, and we'd go out on a Thursday night, and then the board meeting would be all day Friday and Saturday, and we'd fly home Sunday. And it was with 14 other doctors from around the United States on the board. Bernie Siegel, Chris Northrup, I mean, really some fabulous people,
yeah.
Big names.
Yeah.
And I would come home and I'd be like a balloon that had just been blown up to the greatest. And by about 4 days later, it was like all the air had gone out of the balloon
because
I was back with people who weren't necessarily my tribe. I got along well with my colleagues, but they didn't think like I did.
Right.
And so Diane, my wife, said, you know, there's a couple holistic, she was a holistic nurse. There's a couple holistic nurses I know in the Twin Cities. Why don't we get together with them? So like most great ideas, it's one's wife who does the thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, good idea. So she called them. I called a physical therapist I knew, and 10 of us got together at this nurse's home in St. Paul. It's on a Saturday morning, and they wanted to meet and you know, I said, let's just go around the room. Who are you? What do you do? And what's one thing in your practice that's exciting you? And so they wanted to meet every month. It was so much fun. And I said, we can't come up every month.
Right.
But let's do every quarter, Saturday morning.
Okay.
And so 30 years later, we're still meeting on Saturday morning quarterly.
Every quarter. What was the makeup of the group at that point?
4 or 5 nurses, one me, one doctor, one physical therapist, one energy healer, maybe a couple others I can't think of.
Yeah.
And so then when we're going around the room at these meetings on these Saturday mornings, I would sit there with my little pad and, like, I remember that second meeting, someone said, well, my favorite thing in my practice was a nurse. They said, doing Reiki. And so I said, what's Reiki? And she said what it was. So at the end of the meeting, I'd go up to 2 or 3 of them and say, you know, would you talk at the next meeting about it? So after that, every Saturday morning when we met, the first hour would be going around the room telling who they were, what they did, and something in their practice exciting them. The next 2 hours, because it was 9 to 12, the next 2 hours would be on giving a 20, 30-minute talk on something that I had asked them to talk about that they were doing that I didn't know anything about.
Yeah.
So that's why I say it was really selfish and narcissistic. It's like, what do I need? What do I want? Okay, I'm going to go get it.
But I feel like that's, it's funny because this same conversation has come up a bunch of times on the podcast, which is, most of the people who get really good at whatever it is, their skill in health, almost always relates to a problem that they're trying to solve for themselves.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
And it's maybe more specific to health than other fields, partly because I think in some ways we're all trying to just improve our experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's really the point of health. It was interesting looking back through, I'm going to pull up something from your past, which you may or may not even remember, but I found this thing about re-envisioning healthcare. And there was, I don't know if you remember this, but someone put it on a blog and it was written, these were like 8 transitions that you thought, this was in 2008, that would improve healthcare. And I thought it was sort of interesting because there's some of this stuff I feel like is the essence of what, you know, really trying to improve people's like well-being and just whole experience is all about. So I'm going to go through a few, I'm not going to go through all of them, but a couple of them that like really struck my attention were transitioning from a business to a calling,
mm-hmm.
You know, in terms, I'm guessing you were talking about, do you remember any of this?
Oh, yeah. People going into healthcare always went in with a calling and big empathy and stuff.
Yeah.
And then business in the 70s, 80s started taking over. And I was part of that transition. I saw it happen about the mid-80s. There was almost a flip.
Yeah.
And suddenly it became a business more than a calling.
Yeah. And then the transition from science to being an art. Again, I feel like that's really the history, you know, of medicine, and suddenly we became so science-based, and now we're trying to get back to the
those two are quite similar in the business and the healing.
It's true,
you know, it went from pretty much all art, not a lot of science, to way too much science in the sense that we lost the human part, the spirit part of it, the humanity of it, yeah. And it was just with the science of it. And now we're hopefully coming back to some nice middle point where we have good science and the art of healing.
And to me, that was like the whole heart of integrative health. You know, really looking at what we're even talking about with integrative health. I think it's become this like, you know, catchphrase now, and there's not a lot of real integration going on in the way that we're like looking at whole as people, as whole beings, as whole experiencers, or however we want to say it. That we're really just looking at the finite parts of those people, but we're not putting them all together in terms of like how can we improve the wholeness of this and have some sort of coordination in the effort. I mean, that's the thing that I've been working on for, you know, the last 10 years in my career is it's really about me building these, you know, relationships or partnerships with the people that I am aligned with in my practice. And it's not easy to find them actually. And once I get a few of them, but you know, I've done some work out at Northwestern, doing some lectures and talking about business. And one of the things that I try to remind students of is that really that is your business. You know, if you can take yourself out of the equation, you know, eventually, if you're not the most important part of your business, then you've got a business, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's this network that you provide for people that's really what they're coming to you for eventually. We all have a certain amount of skill, but we're all limited in that skill too, you know? So taking the narcissism out of it.
That's a nice way to put it, yeah.
And then one of the other ones that really struck me was the focus, the, you know, transition from the focus on individual health to community health, mm-hmm. because we are really only as well as our community is when it comes to the impacts that, you know, that our how our sense of well-being is laid out has to do with what our community looks like.
Yeah, it's a both and. At times we need a broken bone fixed or a ruptured appendix taken care of, but we've forgotten that there's also the whole, the community, how important it is of just how if we feel a sense of tribe and feel of neighborliness and all the, you know, feeling that our life has meaning and purpose. Those things are really what at the big picture make health. You know, there's the determinants of health,
right.
You have poverty, all these other things. And they've been shown over and over again that if you have very low determinants of health, you just have a basically healthy population. If you have very high, you have a very sick population.
Right.
So the determinants of health are looking at the broader public health picture, and they're pretty important.
Yeah. And how the two kind of feed off one another, you know. I mean, I think about this a lot, you know, when we look at like, you know, the big diseases, the cancers, diabetes, you know, some of these things that I think are very much impacted by how we're feeling, you know, our level of well-being I've done a few food podcasts in the last month or so, and it's interesting because I'm looking at it from different angles, from people who do work with cancer patients to people who are really just trying to improve they have, you know, cholesterol issues, or they're, you know, getting up there into the category of being overweight or obese, and how to get out of that pattern. And, you know, I feel like almost all of it tends to, you know, circulate around what their environment is like, you know, the environment that they grew up in, and then what their current environment is like in terms of what their work, you know, load is, or work stresses and family stresses and all that stuff. I feel like it all becomes very interrelated. And like you said, if you have a broken bone or your appendix ruptures or something like that, we are so fortunate to have Western medicine, but there's so much going on right now that we're just not able to sort of deal with, you know, basic human needs too, that lead to the health complications that we end up addressing. And that kind of leads a little bit to a couple of the other things. One of them I liked was unrealistic expectations, transitioning from that into realistic expectations, you know, and sort of the idea I think you had was going from living in fear of illness and death to an acceptance that fear and death are a normal part of life. Mm-hmm. I thought that was great. And I haven't heard anybody say it in that way before. And that you would say, and also that these are these things. You know, it's like we like to think of things as so black and white.
Yeah. But. I'm a middle child, so I always see both sides of it. One of the big changes that I've loved is having palliative care practitioners, nurses, and doctors, because I think we went a little crazy with trying to keep people alive, and then that sort of shifted to the norm that everybody said, I need to stay alive as long as I can possibly, and so give me any treatment you want for this cancer. And you know, I think now with palliative care practitioners coming in to help you talk it over with the family and everything, a lot of people just say, no, I think I'll, you know, unless you have dramatic proof that this treatment helps, which so often we don't with cancer treatments especially, I think I'll just skip it and go home. And there are many more people now doing that than 5 and 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And they just, study after study shows they have a better quality of life and death.
So it's
an interesting change.
And that's something that I think a lot of people don't, because we live in this sort of fear of death, we don't want to think about what our death experience might be like. And so we get to that end point and have made no decisions whatsoever about what to do at that point.
And the
financial consequences of you know, just maintaining breathing, basically, or heart rate. You and I have kind of an interesting similar background that I thought was the, when we met the first time and started talking about our backgrounds, that we both got into medicine after being English majors.
That's right.
So do you have any thoughts about that years after? Because you're one of the few people that I've actually met in medicine who started out, you know, that way. Do you think it's affected the way that you think about medicine and the way that you've practiced?
Yes, I definitely think it did. And it started out, I was going to be a coach. I liked athletics, but college athletics was not as much fun as high school athletics. And so about end of sophomore year, I went to a guidance counselor and we took a test. And number one was to be a rancher, and number three was to be a farmer, and because I had just been working on farms and ranches in my summers, and I loved the outdoors. In retrospect, I realized what I loved was the independence. You know, they're pretty independent people. You just do your thing, and I found myself pretty independent as a practitioner. Anyway, number eight was physician, and I'm looking at the list. I think I'll be a physician, and the counselor said, "Well, have you thought of that before?" "No." You've talked about people? "No, I've never thought about it." He said, "Why are you picking?" I said, "I don't know. I just looked at it and said, I think I'll be a physician." He said, "Well, no, there's got to be a reason." I said, "Well, I remember a house call where our local physician in my little town, I was pretty sick, and he paid a house call and came to me. And I remember he checked me over, and when he left, and then I felt better. He hadn't done anything. And I felt quite a bit better after he left. And so that impressed me. But if I don't know, I'd never given it a thought till you asked me right now." So,
what do you think about that experience now?
Well, I think that study after study has shown that the power of someone in a position of power, like a doctor, nurse, counselor, priest, minister, rabbi, if they are there and really hear you and listen to you and give you soothing comfort, that your whole immune system then kicks into gear, and it's not just all in your head, it's that it truly is healing.
Yeah.
And that's what it felt like, that he was coming to my house in my bed, looking over me, being nice to me, checking me over. I don't even think he gave a treatment or anything, but it's like I got well the next day.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, so much of our healing is our own fears, our own immune system, our own just fear, you know, what we're afraid of.
Yeah, and the pattern of sort of being in that for long periods of time, I think we only know people from wherever we meet them, you know, and so you don't always know. You see someone who's very anxious and, you know, fearful of coming into your room, but we don't know what that whole, you know, backstory is.
So the guidance counselor at college says to me, talked about being a physician, and I said, "What do you want to major in?" And I said, "Well, what can I major in?" He said, "Anything." And I said, "Really, I don't have to major in physics or biochemistry or, you know, something?"
Yeah.
And he said, "No, we just have changed. Medical schools have just changed now that you can pretty much, used to be, had to major. You have to take some pre-med courses, but you don't have to major in." And I said, wow. And I'm sitting there thinking, he said, what do you like to do? I said, I like to read. He said, why don't you major in English? I said, great, I can major in English. So that's how much that's how much thought it took right then. I think half the doctors should be majoring in English or philosophy or history.
I think that's true, too.
Because it gives you just this broad picture of humanity and of the world. And so much of what we do in our practice, especially in primary care, it relates to the people's lives and who they are as human beings.
Yeah.
So
I have a good friend who's a doctor whose mother was an art teacher, and he was determined. He ended up going to St. John's as well, but he's much younger than me. And he was very sort of driven, got done with college in 3 years, had really like worked hard in high school, worked hard in college, was all ready to go to school. And when he started applying for medical schools, they didn't accept him.
Ooh.
And it was kind of a big wake-up call. And it's interesting how that little shift, you know, changed the courses of things in his life. But he ended up working sort of as an apprentice to an orthopedic surgeon who started giving him all these different things, papers to write for him and help him out with different kinds of things. And he started unlocking all this like creative side of himself that he didn't even realize. And then from there went into medical school and ended up getting into Georgetown. So it was like not really a problem.
Wow.
But it really says something about like that whole idea of thinking about things just from a science-based perspective or from just thinking about this very narrow view, or the way that we've, you know, the way that the system has gotten less generalized. You know, yeah. I think that there are problems. There are some good things about it. Obviously, there are some people who are excelling in like amazing areas, but then we also have lost some of the generality, which I think was a big part of. I mean, it seems like naturally who you are and why you've put yourself in the center of like all of these different kinds of, you know, ways of healing.
Yeah.
That I think should be we should be more exposed to in medical fields at an earlier point too.
Yeah, we need all kinds, and I think one of the things that would be helpful is more help for young pre-med and medical students to figure out who they are. You know, and some are much narrower and do better with a very defined field, and others of us are more generalists, but we don't get much help in figuring that out. And I think we're at a stage where there's the kind of testing and counseling that'd be pretty easy to say, oh, I'm this kind of a Myers-Briggs person, and they have this kind of Enneagram, I have this kind of astrologic field, yeah. That I clearly shouldn't become a brain surgeon.
Right,
you know,
right.
But when we don't get much help on that, it's much harder to figure out. I had a couple times, I had a student at Mayo Clinic, and she spent a 2-month rotation with a radiologist, and he was just great. And it was like her middle of junior, early senior year when she was applying to residency. So she decided to go into radiology. Mm. Well, after a year in radiology or a year and a half, she decided, I'm not a radiologist.
Yeah.
But, and then she realized, oh, it's because that person was so good.
Right.
And
right.
I just sort of went in, and she had no other help. And so then she struggled, left medical school for a while, didn't know what to do. Left residency.
Yeah.
You know, we need more help with students at all levels to help them figure out who they are.
It's so important when you consider, like, what you're saying is, you know, like, really starting to ask the hard questions at a much earlier point, because these medical students that are out, you know, coming out of school now are going into residency are going to have $300,000 to $400,000 in debt,
right.
And you know, we all think doctors get paid well, but you don't for a while. And
we get paid plenty, but
right.
But the amount of debt is fairly huge.
But the amount of with that kind of debt, I mean, I think you end up getting stuck in a system. I mean, you know, the first 5 years of your, you know, between residency and getting into your first, you know, career, you know, decision, it's still not a lot of money when you consider how much money you're going to have to pay back, you know, with that kind of debt. I think it ends up forcing people to like get stuck in the business of medicine rather than on the art of it.
Have you ever seen the YouTube by Z-Dog? It's about the, it starts out with about burnout.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
an 11-minute
yeah,
thing,
yeah.
or 6 minutes, pretty
yeah,
short. But
yeah.
Z-D-O-G-G, he's a doc who gives little YouTube things.
Yeah, I've seen it.
And he talks about, this is not burnout, this is moral injury. And I started crying when I because I've never heard it called moral injury, and I knew immediately he named it. And when you name something that you know deep in you, I just tears start pouring out. It was so powerful because he says doctors go in with big empathy genes and want to help, and then they get caught in a system where all they're doing is just running through patients, and they have a moral injury. And so there's like every week there's two doctor deaths, suicides, something every year now.
Yeah, I believe it's the highest. I believe it's the highest suicide rate profession now.
Yeah, it's just like a couple every week. Come on.
Yeah.
It's.
Yeah. And I think there's some other stuff going on there that I don't totally understand, but I think, and I, strangely or not so strange, I treat a lot of doctors. pretty much every job I've had where I've worked in a clinic setting, I've spent at least a third of my time treating the staff.
Yeah, you know, with the craniosacral therapy,
with craniosacral especially.
Yeah,
yeah, and you know, whether it's I've worked with psych, I've worked with
doesn't matter.
Generally, we're all kind of in the same thing, you know, and it's not an easy thing to, you know, to hold that space for people day in and day out for long periods of time.
In the 60s and 70s, I don't think I knew a doctor who didn't pretty much like practicing medicine.
Yeah.
And by the year 2000, I couldn't say that at all. I knew 100 doctors. I knew, you know, still a lot of them like it, but it really has changed in the 40 years. There's a lot of, I think, not just burnout, but moral injury as the system changed, became more businesslike.
Yeah. Where was your first job?
Well, after internship, I was in the Peace Corps for 3 years, so I was working at an Aborigine hospital in Malaysia.
Oh, wow.
And then I transferred and did a year in Ghana, where doing public health, helping set up a malaria eradication TB control program. Then family medicine started as a specialty. Hmm. Family medicine didn't exist until late 60s. And so in 1970, I went and did my last 2 years of family medicine residency. And so then I went to Mankato and started practice.
Where did you do your internship?
Santa Barbara, California, then Peace Corps for 3 years, then the last 2 years of family medicine residency in Oklahoma City.
Huh.
There were only 8 programs then. Now there's 200.
Yeah.
But there were only, so it was easy to choose. I looked through a little list. And
yeah. So with family practice at that point, what kind of stuff did you field? What was your sort of daily work like?
Oh, it was just really great. That's one of the things, Jeremy, is that I think at first, when I had my first years in the 70s in Mankato, probably if I don't count newborn, well-child checks and OB visits and just counted the other patients who came in, probably 70% of my patients came in with acute care.
Yeah.
They had asthma or bronchitis or colds or ear infections or broken bones or lacerations because there was no doctors in the ER at that time, even in Mankato, a big town. There weren't doctors there.
Yeah.
It's like I was on call. There were, say, 30 of us, and we each took one 24-hour shift in the ER. But that didn't mean we were in the ER. We were in our office. So when I'm at the ER, if you came in with an auto accident, they'd call me, and I'd leave my office and go up to the ER to see you.
Huh.
There weren't ER doctors, and so your average ER, you know, your sick patients came in, and by the time I left, it was a reverse. It was 20% of my patients were acute care and 80% were chronic care. It just, the whole system had shifted. So I had this nice blend in a practice of seeing regular OB visits and well child checks. So that's whole thing.
Yeah.
And then seeing some chronic patients with problems, and then seeing another third of the practice that had just acute care.
Yeah.
And it was a beautiful blend. And now when every doctor sits in that office, they see no acute care. They primarily see pretty sick, chronically ill people who we don't know what to do with them.
Right.
Because they have environmental problems or all sorts of other problems. And so it's much more frustrating to practice outpatient medicine.
That's interesting to think. I think back a lot of times to I was a child in the 70s. So
yeah.
My mom single parent child. So I know my mom didn't have a lot of money for medical care, but you know, stuff came up. I broke my arm, messed up my knee one time. You know, I was pretty young when some of this stuff happened, and just the way that I sort of went through the system, it seemed more relaxed and easier. And you know, when I think back about, because and I think, you know, we all kind of model the way that we end up sort of practicing, I think, based on what our experience was, right? I mean, there's bits and pieces of all these different doctors probably that we knew that we, you know, kind of think about. But when I hear you say this, that things have changed to this degree, there's clearly something going on, you know, in our environment that's also has to be problematic.
So the amount of chronic disease, I saw a year ago in an article, and it wasn't referenced, so I don't know how accurate it is, but it said the incidence of chronic disease in the United States in the last 30 years has gone up 3,000%. And I looked at that and I said, absolutely. It just, people, when I talk to medical students, like, and I would say, no, in the 60s and 70s, I didn't have one patient with type 2 diabetes. In the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I maybe had three people I diagnosed with depression. Now, and I gave all my new patients a depression scale. Yes, I might have missed a little depression, right, but right. People just weren't very depressed in rural southern Minnesota. Uh-huh. And chronic fatigue didn't exist, except for one patient every 3 months.
Or right, right.
Those kind of chronic, tough problems that now physicians don't know what to do about it. It's really changed. Practice is really changing. There's a great book out by Victoria Sweet, a physician from San Francisco, and it's called Slow Medicine. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've heard of it, but it just is one of my favorite because I've been calling it acute care medicine is what we do now well in Western medicine.
Yeah.
But chronic care medicine is we're doing a lousy job. Well, and those are never good names. She named it fast medicine, which is our ER hospital mm-hmm. medicine that we do well. And then she called chronic care medicine slow medicine. It's just, and they're like two different things. We shouldn't even call it medicine or the same name. Because outpatient chronic care medicine, just we have to so much go upstream to figure out, well, why is your body doing this?
Right.
You know.
It's all backtracking at that point.
It's all backtracking. Well, why? What's it in its wisdom trying to do? Well, you have got asthma and all that stuff because you've got mold in your house. Mm-hmm. Or you've got, you know, this because of you're sitting at a computer 10 hours a day. But we're not doing that. We're just sort of looking at the symptom just like we would acute care, treating it with a pharmaceutical and moving on. So I think that's going to be the biggest change that's going to happen. We're going to now. And you know who's taking over that role of doing good chronic care medicine? Our chiropractors and naturopaths and physical therapists and, a whole lot of other people.
It's been a big part of my practice.
Craniosacral therapist.
I get a lot of these idiopathic, people sent to me because they've been to 20 people already.
Right.
And they're not getting better. And I have my limited toolbox and I'm just trying to think of ways, with what I know, or I first just have to have the experience of like my hands on this person and see what goes on and start developing this relationship and getting as much information as I can from them. And sometimes there's like very small things that I also pick up from them that are like, no one asked you this question yet. And sometimes it's a very simple thing.
Yeah.
I had this really actually interesting thing. This was probably maybe 7 or 8 years ago. 10-year-old boy comes brought in by his mom, and he's having these panic attacks, and they seem to be, I can't remember how they had done all these neurological tests with him basically, and I mean he had been through the ringer, really smart kid. They started thinking he's probably on the spectrum, or he has some kind of he's got an anxiety disorder, or maybe he's depressed. And you and I were talking about some of this stuff before, so I feel like it leads right into it. Turns out, I just asked the right question, and I said, tell me about the last time that it happened. And he said, well, I was walking down the sidewalk, and this big truck came by, made really loud noise. I said, oh, that's interesting. And when I was treating him, I was working around his temporal bones, and all of a sudden, he said, I hear fluid. I hear fluid moving. So that's interesting. And I think he had some sort of block, in his inner ear, and he stopped having panic attacks.
And it released. Yeah.
That's a very physiological thing that I was able to address. But then you deal with things like EMFs, mold, Lyme, all these other things where we can't even, the different chemical components from crops and these things that we can't even identify. And one of my friend who I was telling you about, he was at Mayo for a while, and he said, this is one of the sickest towns I've ever worked in. And he thinks it's from something that's in the air or something that's, you know,
in Rochester.
In Rochester, from the, you know, from the farmland that's, you know, just kind of floating into that area. And he just, one thing after another,
well,
that he's seen.
The Roundup glyphosate could be floating in.
Right,
you know, it could be getting into the drinking water. It, who knows? You know, it makes me think of a story of just the difference of slow medicine and fast medicine. Last summer, we have a bunch of us, my kids, my nephews, and I go up to one of the nephews' cabins and play golf for a couple days. Mm-hmm. And so it's on the first night after the 18 holes. And now I hadn't used my upper body much or anything before, you know, and so I golfed 18 holes. And that night we're eating dinner around the cabin I started getting heartburn and indigestion. And I said, excuse me, I'm gonna go lie down a little bit. It's 7 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And so I'm lying there, and my son, who's an osteopathic physician out in Maine, who does only osteopathic manipulation, he doesn't do much pharmaceutical medicine.
Wow.
And anyway, he came in and said, turn around on the bed, Dad. And I'm pouring out. At this point, I've got a lot of chest pain, and I'm sort of filling up a glass about every 10 minutes with just discharge from my mouth. So much liquid is coming out. Huh. It's that. And so and he starts working on my head, and after about doing some stuff, and about 5, 6, 7 minutes later, I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm just doing some manipulation. And I said, well, why? He said, why? I said, because I'm about 50% better, and this is impossible, that you could be doing something with my head. And he said, well, and he just did a little more, and in about 15 minutes, I was 100%. I'd quit discharging the medication, the fluid, the spit, and I had no chest pain. I said, what'd you do? He said, well, I figured you hadn't used your upper body much. You golfed 18 holes today. I figured maybe your vagus nerve was having a problem.
Yep.
And so I'm working. I said, oh, is there a vagus nerve back there? You know, medical doctors, we totally forget our anatomy.
Right.
And he said, yeah. And I said, well, what does that have to do with this? And he says, well, it goes down and the esophageal gastric junction, it has right in the diaphragm area. And I said, and so that was it. 20 minutes later, and I was 100% normal.
Yeah.
And I said, Tim, do you realize that I was close to needing to go to an ER? I would have gone to an ER. I would have gotten a total cardiac workup.
Yep.
They would have said, I don't see any heart damage, and they would have sent me home.
You might have got some reflux
meds. And I might have gotten an H2 blocker. And I would have been on H2 blocker for the next 10 years.
Right, right.
You know? I mean, and I thought, oh, my God, this is a metaphor for right now for medicine in general.
Yeah.
And you, as a craniosacral, must see it all the time where they've been through everything, and then you do two treatments of craniosacral, and... You know, but this was so dramatic because I'm a pretty good doctor, but it never occurred to me that, oh, my body just got overworked. Vagus nerve got pinched with tight muscles.
Yeah.
All I did was a little release it, and suddenly I'm normal.
It's surprising. And, you know, I've talked to, you know, I've talked to some other osteopaths on the podcast, and there are things that even from our understanding, I mean, I've worked with kids with extreme allergies that just go, and like stuff that I don't even know if I can completely explain. But when you're when getting back to this, idea of slow medicine, it's not that slow. I mean, you know, when it comes right down to it, that I could, you know, within an hour or with the child, within 30 minutes, you know, that's about how long my sessions usually are, that I can have this kind of effect is... It's surprising. It's I mean, what I charge, and I, you know, unfortunately, insurance won't reimburse for me. So I've had to work outside of that, and I can, you know, HSA will cover my costs and stuff like that. So there's ways, you know, for people to come see me and use some kind of insurance-based dollars. But that it's such a cost-effective way of at least trying as an initial piece. Let's see what happens with this. Let's see if I suspect there's like a history of trauma, you know, if something comes through an intake or something that they will just tell me, or there's been something recent like a loss of a parent or child, you know, these are all the kinds of things that I see, but they have physiological issues.
Absolutely.
Going on too.
Yeah.
Let me just focus on what I know I can help this person with, which is relaxation response, helping balance their autonomic system. And let's just see let's see what that next week looks like after that. And a lot of times there's a big shift that goes on.
Well, it's why a lot of the chiropractors are changing their practices into, you know, they're working with kids with ADHD and hyperactivity short attention spans, because that's a lot of that stuff is nerve related. And if you move the body around in certain ways and the muscles and fascia, makes huge changes. Yeah. And they're chiropractic neurologists. They're helping people with post-concussion syndrome.
Yeah,
I've had two people, friends, who weren't getting better after 6 months of physical therapy, and both of them were healed in a month with a chiropractic neurologist.
Yes.
And I go, you know, this was back 4 or 5 years ago. What's a chiropractic neurologist? I'd never heard of it. So the whole primary care is changing so much, and I think medical doctors are sort of being left out of it. We're not training them well in outpatient medicine.
Yeah. And this is part of the reason I wanted to talk to you, because I feel like you are forward thinking in a way that I think I don't even want to say that other doctors aren't. I actually think a lot of doctors are. They don't have, or they haven't put themselves in the center of things like you have.
Yeah.
and it is, you know, it's, you and I had this conversation before about curiosity and about that being one of the, you know, one of the other missing pieces, and that, you know, your curiosity was what really drove this, you know, your the whole of your career, basically.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things that I think, you know, going back to the medical student, how do we get that into the teaching? Because I feel like that's really what's needed right now.
Yeah, we really do need to, especially in residency. That, you know, medical school is a basic learning, but those 3 years of residency are where we really need to do a different job. And I started a rural residency in Mankato back in the 90s, and I just, after 3 years, I had to leave because I just wasn't allowed by the Academy of Family Practice to teach it in the way I thought it should be taught.
Yeah.
It was still basically doing teaching the way I'd been taught 30 years earlier.
Yeah.
Just an example, I had one of the women of my first-year resident who knew she wanted to have kids, knew she didn't want to do OB, and so I contacted the academy or the board to see if I could skip her OB training, which is quite extensive for family docs.
Yeah.
And they said no. And I said, that doesn't make any sense. Why would I have 3 years of training in OB if she knows she's not going to do deliveries?
Yeah.
Well, it's because family doctors are womb to tomb. And I said, that's, you know, and I had a lot of things like that. A lot of things came up. I would contact them and see, can I know you have to do this? A family doctor has to know how to do deliveries. And that, seeing that kind of rigidity, that was constant through my program. And so after 3 years, I stepped down. And
yeah.
Because I could have taught them holistic and integrative medicine, I could have taught them community health stuff, how to look out at the community and look at the bigger picture.
Right. And I think, you know, I don't have a problem with specialty per se, but I think what ends up happening is if you try to kind of veer out of specialty, there are kind of blockers for you almost. It's like, no, you stay in your little box over here, you know. And I think we should allow for growth in a career, you know. Just because you spent some time, you know, working in infectious disease doesn't mean you can't move into, you know, something more general. I think that specialty is now going to be a huge bonus to whatever your practice is.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been lucky in my career to just kind of, I think mine was sort of like yours in a way that I was just directed by the community as to what it needed. You know, I didn't plan on working with babies. That was I was kind of starting out working with mostly orthopedic issues. I liked working with, because I'm similar to you, I had a background in sports. I liked solving these kinds of orthopedic challenges, and having, you know, gotten into this field to solve my own. I liked that. But, you know, as I was also becoming a parent and also seeing other parents and the anxiety of parents around different health challenges with kids, and then learning kind of, you know, what a lot of the early, you know, nursing challenges are, digestive issues, I just kind of, you know, my heart just kind of went out to some of these parents, and, you know, I just got involved. And then I went back and studied pediatric work, just because I felt like, well, I'm in this community. Nobody else seems to be resourcing this. And it, you know, it took a while before the medical, you know, places that there was about four pediatric practices in that area that were all pretty set. They've been there for quite a while. And there are a lot more now even, but they were kind of resistant, except for one who was the longest time there, and she taught at Columbia, and she ended up becoming involved in one of my child's illnesses. My daughter had meningitis as a baby.
Ouch.
Scary one, but she's fine, and she did great. But it was kind of amazing that I had developed a relationship with her before this happened with my daughter, because it would, to have that kind of resource at that moment in my life was crucial.
Absolutely.
You know, I think what they started realizing was that when there was a baby who was, you know, failing to thrive, or, you know, whatever they call it, or they were really not putting on weight well, or they were concerned about head growth, or, you know, those kinds of things, they would call on me and say, will you take a look at this baby and just let me know what you think? You know,
that's great.
It's nice.
In the Brooklyn area.
And that was in the Brooklyn area. To have and to feel like someone saw my usefulness, you know, as a practitioner. It was pretty specialized, but you know, oddly enough, now I've become more general in the way that I've worked with a lot of mental health and, you know, babies and orthopedics, and now a lot of these sort of chronic health conditions that are popping up, which is what, you know, you and I kind of wanted to dig into a little more today too.
Every obstetric labor and delivery place should have somebody doing cranial sacral with the newborns.
Yeah.
You know, it would make a huge difference.
Yeah, and I think people don't realize just what gentle work it is, and how easy it is for
And how traumatic birth is sometimes.
And I mean, that's,
you know,
that.
We're so
traumatized as parents that we don't realize what what the baby is going through. And now with so many, you know, so many deliveries happening in C-section.
Well, that's true.
And adding Pitocin to the mix and all these different pieces, you know, like it ends up being
a lot of medication.
I think things, again, like we're adding more things to the mix that we just don't really understand the long-term effects of, and how that might have, like one of my instinctive, you know, pieces about working with babies with digestive issues is that there's a couple different things. If the mom receives Pitocin and the baby is vaginally delivered, you know, Pitocin is causes contraction. So, and we have this peristaltic rhythm. We don't know how much the baby is affected by this medication and what that might actually do to the nervous system of the baby.
Right.
So there's that. And then maybe there's something about vaginal delivery that actually allows for peristaltic movement to really kick into gear, because those are the two situations that I often see with babies that I think, you know, I see this over and over again. This is a pattern I see. There's got to be something here. I can't. I don't know if I can measure this in any other way except for this observation. But it's and the same could be true for a lot of the things that you and I were talking about discussing. Mold, I think, and the varying forms of that now really needs to have a real strong testing mechanism as a first, you know, measure, rather than like what you were, you know, suggesting, which is that instead of, and when we have someone who basically seems to have all these other things that we can create names for it, like, oh, that's chronic fatigue, or that's depression, or maybe they actually are in, you know, have mold or some inflammation as it relates to something like that.
Probably somewhere in the next 20 years, we'll be just like in the 60s, 70s, we started routinely checking cholesterol, blood pressure, type 2 for blood sugar. You know, that wasn't done in the 40s and 50s. And then it sort of became, oh, we need to check these things. Somewhere in the next, I hope it's the next 5 years, it'll probably be 25, we'll be routinely checking for glyphosate, for heavy metals, for mold and mycotoxin, for, you know, those will just be routine tests. And lead, you know, it's like all the heavy, it'll change medical care dramatically. And we should be doing it now, you know, pretty routinely, and anybody with a chronic problem. But
What is the cost of these, and these tests aren't covered at the moment?
Some are, and it depends on your plan and, you know, that kind of thing. But they're not, no one is routinely, most of the doctors don't even know how to do them and don't do them. And yet they're probably, half their patients with chronic disease probably are suffering from those problems.
Huh.
It's strange to me, because there's enough evidence, even in the medical literature, that, that there's plenty of these problems, plenty of books out, a lot of papers, but we're not ready to make the change yet. Sort of like dairy, when when a lot of papers came out on that dairy is not good for some people, not just lactose intolerance, but casein is not, you know, it's still, there's not 10 or 20% of doctors in the United States who put people on a dairy elimination diet to even try it. And yet it's a major cause of illness for so many people.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Dairy is just a really troubled food for a lot of people. Yeah. And back, way back in the early 80s, the head of pediatrics at Johns Hopkins wrote a book called Don't Drink Your Milk. And, you know, so it came from the top. Johns Hopkins would be like Mayo, didn't make any difference. Here it is 40 years later, and there's still not a pediatrician who even barely thinks, gets a milk history. Yeah. He had all the data, he had lots of studies, everything.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting from the perspective of babies, you know, and I end up dealing with a lot of these babies too, who they maybe suspect there's some kind of an allergy going on in the way that, you know, they're looking at the stool and saying, well, this is the quality or this is what's going on. And there's also like a lot of refluxy stuff happening, or the baby's not putting on weight. And, you know, it's very rarely the mother's milk that's causing any sort of problems.
No.
Or the,
right.
You know, every once in a while, the mom's diet needs to be adjusted because they're eating dairy or they're eating a lot of acidic foods or something. But almost, you know, most of the babies who end up on formula, or if there's some kind of whey product in the formula, that's when the problems really kick up for the baby. So it becomes sort of obvious to break down at that point. And yet we still, you know, as a culture, I think you're right. We don't really realize the impact of that on our digestive systems.
It should almost, in my opinion, not be a decision that the mother can make, that I'm going to breastfeed or not breastfeed. She has to breastfeed.
Right.
You know, I mean, it just, and if it doesn't work, then that's one thing. But if we supported them in ways right from the beginning, really helped them breastfeed, you know, with nurse midwives and others who
lactation
could do that. Lactation consultants. Most women would be able to breastfeed, and then it would make a huge difference in the amount of illness in the kids.
Yeah, and they're, you know, I don't know if you know about this, but over by North Memorial, they're starting this breast milk bank now, and it's going to be there used to be one in Iowa.
That's great. I didn't know that.
And it's this. I happen to be working with the woman who is writing the grant for it, and the woman who is running the program.
Oh my gosh, that's exciting.
It's really exciting, and you know, the amount of milk that they can take in and process is very expensive equipment to, you know, do, because there's a lot of health concerns around people donating milk. But the, you know, especially for communities, I think, and you know, that part of Minneapolis in particular, I think it's an area that's going to be really well served with something like this, because of the long-term like positive impacts of being able to have access to breast milk if you're unable to produce.
That's great. Yeah,
so
that's
and maybe we'll talk less about some of these other issues if our immune systems can actually, you know, manage. I mean, that's got to be another part of what's going on with us too, that it's not just the things in the environment. It's not one thing. It's not just mold. No. It's not just the way farming is being done. It's like the combination of all these things and the changes, and the speed at which we think we can kind of, you know, produce things in our life, or the everything at the price of productivity is taking its toll on us as beings.
Yeah, the environment is big on the physical environment. Also, are you familiar with the Adverse Childhood Experience questionnaire, the ACE questionnaire?
Yeah.
You know, those 10 questions are overwhelming. If you have zero yes answers, you're just about a 95% chance you're going to be healthy. And if you have 7, 8, 9 yes answers, chances are about 80-90% you're going to have illness.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's a straight curve. So just for the audience, so these questionnaires are, were you raised in a single-parent family? Did you have abuse, physical, emotional, sexual abuse of a child? All those different things.
Yeah, yeah. And isn't food access to different kinds of food a part of it too? I mean, I think a lot of these kids end up in these, you know, parts of cities that are kind of food deserts, so they end up living off of processed foods until, you know, their adult years most of the time.
Yeah.
Well, I wanna just wrap up with a couple of quick questions for you. What would you like to see with this group that you've started? Do you have any vision in terms of what we can do, because I'm part of this group?
The Minnesota Holistic Medicine Group?
Yes. And you know, being now, not, would you say 900 people?
900 practitioners.
Know, 900 practitioners. I because one of my missions, sort of by doing these podcasts, is also to activate more people in both inform people who are you know, either trying to improve their health experience, or people who are involved in health fields, to maybe enlighten them about what's going on in a field that they're you know, don't have a lot of experience with, or to even inspire them to kind of push into something that they thought was kind of a limitation in their field and take off into that. And I feel like that's been kind of your mission too.
Yeah, my three goals from the start have been, number one, to help practitioners in healthcare find other practitioners who are part of their tribe. And by that, I mean who think like we do in a more holistic way and collaborative way. Number two are to learn from each other, because each discipline has its own skills. And then three, to be able to refer appropriately. So baby, it's get to know each other,
yeah.
Learn from each other, and refer appropriately, because I don't even want to refer to an MD that I don't know well.
Yeah.
And so it's the same, how am I going to refer to an acupuncturist or a craniosacral person if I don't know them? And this way we can connect with each other and learn from each other. So yeah, I see that as a continuing goal. I one of the biggest things I see is for medicine to understand that maybe it's time for Western conventional allopathic medicine to do what we really do well, which is what Victoria Sweet calls fast medicine. Mm-hmm. Hospital medicine, ER medicine, acute illness. And the key word is, what's wrong? What's the diagnosis? Well, we do unfortunately, with slow medicine, with chronic illness, we do the same thing. You come in, we make a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. You have asthma, you have depression, you have this, then we give you a pharmaceutical. That's totally the wrong way to practice slow medicine, because diagnosis isn't really important, because if I have 10 people with asthma, I probably should be using 10 different treatments. Mm-hmm. If I have 10 people with depression, maybe two people with depression should be on an SSRI, but one of them needs thyroid changes, one needs to get out of a marriage, one needs to leave a job,
right.
One needs to have body work done because I have pinched nerves that's causing depression, one's having heavy metal or lead poisoning.
Yeah.
You know, I just had a son who was eating tuna fish sandwiches the last 3 years for lunch, and he was sort of a little bit depressed, not doing very well, and he had mercury toxicity. You heard the story.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, this is a really healthy wellness person, and he was really suffering from mercury toxicity from just eating too many tuna fish sandwiches. He had chelation, oral chelation. 3 months later, he's like a new person. It's 2 years later now, and he's just maintained like he, instead of being 50, it's like he's 25.
Yeah.
It's like a new life. And I'm going, how many millions of people are out there like Tim? You know, just the lead toxicity that people are getting from pipes. We think Flint, Michigan. I remember the woman who, the pediatrician, discovered Flint, Michigan and made it a big thing.
Yeah.
She said, if you think Flint, Michigan's a problem, it's the needle in a haystack. We're all suffering from this kind of environmental toxicity because just all our pipes are lead. And you think after 20 years, it's not peeling off on the inside.
Right.
You know, and... So I think it's a really exciting time. These last years, I really thought I'd like to go back into medicine for about the last 10 years. I didn't want to. And now these last three or four.
Is that right?
Because I think it's going to be like the 60s, where we're going to start to go upstream and really look at, well, why are all these people chronically ill? And pretty soon we'll be starting to measure for the roundup in people and their omega-3s and their heavy metals and their... You know, we'll really look at their environment and start mold and mycotoxin, all the different things that, why are people getting chronic Lyme? Why are they doing this? What's happening? And I think all practitioners will have it won't just be in the medical MD system.
Yeah.
I think chiropractors, naturopaths, body workers, everybody, it's going to start having a much bigger role. I think it's an exciting time.
Do you think there's a chance that insurance might actually get to a point in the U.S., where they see the benefit for themselves financially of pulling some of these other parts of the system into insurance care? Or do you think that's not even worth having an involvement with insurance? Do you think it's better for, you know, some of those things to stay outside of the system?
That's a great question, because the insurance runs so much of what we do in medicine. And I don't know. You know, the insurance companies tend to give big salaries to certain people, and they're you know, it's a system that I wish we just went to Medicare for all without a supplement. You know, I can't stand that Medicare, that we have to now go through the same thing by supplements every, you know. Right. Why don't we just have a system that gives care to all? And we would cut down the amount of paperwork. Something I saw, 20% of all healthcare costs just come from the paperwork. Hmm. And even now, when I have Medicare, I have to have a supplement like Blue Cross or something. Yep. Well, the amount of paperwork that comes through is just staggering. I go to one little visit and I get three different sheets of paper coming in the mail about it. Yep. And that's just crazy stuff. If we had a system of basically health coverage for all, sort of like our public school system.
Right.
Why don't we repeat the public school system? Yep. And, you know, if people want to start a few little off the side private places, like we have private schools, that'd be okay. But 90% of people would get their sick care without supplement. Just it'd be one system, and we would change things so dramatically.
Yeah.
So,
well, one other question I have for you, which is a little bit of a selfish question, but I'm curious. I know you're a Dr. Upledger. Dr. John Upledger is one of your heroes. He happens to be mine as well. So I'm just curious to know how you ended up, you know, finding out about him and what your how you became interested in him, how he came onto your radar.
He was at one of our national holistic conferences in Chicago, and Upledger talked that day on general osteopathy, cranial sacral work, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then afterward, he said he was going to do treatments on people for like $5. He would just sort of appear. And so I went up after the talk and asked if I could just stand there with him and help him. Not, you know, just, he said, sure. So I got to stand there for an hour with him while he worked on, he would just do 10-minute visits on people.
Yeah.
And on about the fourth patient, this was in Chicago, on about the fourth person he saw, it happened to be my patient from Mankato, Minnesota. She was at the conference. A teacher at Mankato State University who was teaching health science or something, and she just wanted to go to a holistic conference. It was close enough. And I'd been seeing her for this problem. And so he started working on her, and she started crying. And then, you know, it moves me so much. She... her problem was a frozen left shoulder. Mm-hmm. And I had her see physical therapy. I injected cortisone. I'd done all this different stuff, and nothing was helping. Well, anyway, she cried and cried as he was working on her. And then so afterwards, she went out, and I followed her, and I sort of left, and I said, what happened? What came up for you as he was working on you? And she said, 25 years ago when I was 17, I got pregnant. And I sat in my bedroom at the window with my arm like this, that left arm, with my head on it, wondering what to do. I ended up having an abortion, but I've never forgiven myself. And this left shoulder had started bothering like 30 years later. Mm-hmm. And so she had a frozen shoulder. So he did this little work on her. And then, of course, I followed her up when I got back home. And the problem was gone, and she never had another problem. And he had released something energetically that blocked, you know, why did it start 30 years later?
Yeah.
You know, but the body's a strange thing. And then the other thing he did was I'm up at sort of just watching him. He says, okay, put your hand under this woman's sacrum, under the seat, and just put your hands on the sacrum.
Yeah.
So I did. And I did, you know, 3 minutes later, and then suddenly I'm feeling this huge pulsation.
Yeah.
And he looks at me and smiles. And he's working on the head and neck. Yeah. And I'm going, wait, this isn't the pulse. This isn't a pulse. So I took one hand off and felt her femoral pulse because I thought, well, is this the blood vessel?
Right.
But it wasn't. I'm feeling one pulse here, and I'm feeling, and it's going whoosh, whoosh.
Yeah.
And I go, Dr. Upledger, this is the craziest thing. And he laughed. He smiled and said, pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he had released energy. I mean, it was like I might as well have had him fly in the air.
Right.
Because it's impossible to my way of thinking as a young doctor that you could be playing around with somebody's head and neck, and I'm feeling it down in the sacrum, this energy. And he just said, that's energy.
Yeah.
And so that, talk about changing a worldview.
I can imagine. What year was this?
Oh, gosh, probably the late 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he had probably already started his school at that point.
I think maybe he was just starting his school about that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would have been late 80s, early 90s, somewhere right in there.
It's pretty incredible. And one of my early experiences just taking coursework with, you know, some of his, a lot of the early, you know, students of his have become teachers, you know, through the Upledger Institute. And so I've worked with a number of them now, and their stories are incredible. You know, I never got to meet him myself. So from what I've heard, he's a very intense guy, and his presence is, you know, quite something. But he's also like incredibly sensitive, incredibly, you know, book smart and detailed in the way that his books are like, you know, so well put together in terms of like all the anatomy, every single, and if there's any mystery in there, he's really kind of leaving that open, you know, and I think that's kind of an amazing thing. And what you saw happen with this woman was what we call somato-emotional release, which is just the way that we sort of store this information in our bodies. And we all have, you know, different kinds of things. And, you know, really, it takes someone to really be, you know, sort of attentive and have their intention be in the right place when you're working with them for you to be able to have the experience that this woman had of being able to go right back into that sense of, you know, what was going on with her, you know, her at that point in her life and how she felt it in her shoulder and that she was able to release that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I hope it's like the cylindrical thing that we do all, you know, before 1940s, we didn't have a lot. And so we did all emotional, spiritual, social type of medicine.
Yeah.
And then in the last 60 or 70 years, we've had these incredible advances. So we move the spiral, goes now all we do is physical medicine. We forget that we're spiritual, social, emotional beings besides being physical.
Right.
And so I hope these next 50 years will be some balance of, yes, there's a place for the physical, but let's not forget that we're also spiritual, emotional, social beings, that we need to look at everything.
Yeah, I agree, and I do think that there is something happening these last few years that is shifting, and I think part of it might be just that people are waking up to the fact that there's plenty of people who, just talking to doctor friends of mine, there are plenty of people who just don't care about their health, but I think there are also people who are starting to realize that who they are and how they feel and what they want to do with their lives and all these things are dependent on paying attention to what's going on, and they're seeking the kinds of care practitioners who are going to help them through that, you know. And I think in some ways, health coaching is becoming a bigger sort of model for things, and I think I hear they get made fun of sometimes, and I think that's not quite fair, because it really does take a certain amount of guidance to take somebody through a process. We have to become our own advocates at this point in medicine as patients. And we really should have more help than that, you know? And if there are people who are willing to really throw themselves in there and say, let me hold your hand through the beginning of this and get you to the right, the right people, or get you into the right practices, that's really something that's crucial right now.
I'm really glad you brought that up. If I had to say what's the biggest change I think is going to happen, when in the last 50 years, the primary care doctor, the family doc, the internist, the pediatrician was that health guide.
Yes.
And in 1992, my wife and I wrote an article for the American Holistic Medical Association newsletter that said the primary care doctor of the future is going to be nurse practitioners, naturopaths, health coaches, that hadn't even been invented, and chiropractors.
Huh.
And I can't find the article, but I remember it so well because we sort of were laughing, saying, I wonder if this is true. Well, in the last 5 or 10 years, when health coaching came, I went bingo. Because I go, when I'm talking to like groups, I'll say, how many of you have a fitness coach? Well, quite a few.
Right, right, right.
How many of you have a tax accountant coach? Almost everybody has a tax person.
Yeah.
How many of you have a financial advisor? Well, if they're in the medical profession, they have a financial. I say, okay, and how many of you have a medical coach, a health coach?
Yeah.
And almost none of them, you know, they'll, maybe half of them, but I'll say, and how easy is it to get into your primary care doctor? And, you know, and I say, what's going to happen in the next 20, 30 years is everybody's going to have a health coach. That's going to be the go-to person. that they'll just be on call, and that they're holding your hand to help you. Here's what you need to see. No, you don't need to see an MD or DO. You need to see an acupuncturist or an Ayurvedic practitioner or a psychologist. Or
you need these tests for metals. Or you need
or yeah, yeah, here's something very specific. Here's a person who specializes in heavy metal stuff and in this. And I think the whole, because who doesn't want, you know, sort of their own doctor? And that's what the health coach is going to be. It's going to be, because even one of my really good friends is my doctor.
Yeah.
Do you think I can call her and talk to her? No, I get the nurse. And then I have to talk to the nurse. And then she goes, talks to the doctor. And then she calls me back, but she didn't get the story straight. And so yeah. I break all the rules and I say, Laura, I email her and I say on her personal email, Laura, I'm sorry, but I'm going around the system. I have this question of you. And then she'll email me back. But I realize that's a very privileged position.
Yeah.
But everybody wants that. You just want to talk to your doctor. You don't want to talk to the nurse and through them and then get back an answer.
Yeah.
So that's the health coach. I think health coaching is going to be really a big thing.
I think you're totally right about that.
Yeah.
Well, this has been super fun, Bill. I hope we get to do another one of these at some point. Maybe we'll pick another topic for another day.
That'd be great.
All
okay.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Bill Manahan, folks. So great to see how much passion and excitement Bill still has for his work, even in retirement. I've seen him speak before at the Minnesota Holistic Medical Group, and he's got a great sense of humor, actually. And it's clear that his vocation continues. And I can only wish that in my retirement will be so fruitful. What really struck me, though, in this conversation is Bill's ability to hold two seemingly divergent concepts and understand how and why both are essential to each other. I think it's why we both connect over Dr. Upledger's work. And it gets to the heart of what's meant by holistic, seeing the whole beyond the parts. Let me know what you thought of this topic in conversation. You can email me at jeremy@highwaytohealthpodcast.com. You can also connect with me through the highwaytohealthpodcast.com website on the contact form. And you'll be able to see our entire library of guests there on the site for free. And don't forget to visit our Patreon page to learn more about this project. You see a 2-minute video of me talking about the future, what I'd like to see happen with this project, and you can show your support there and become a sponsor. If you know someone who you think would benefit from hearing this conversation as well, by all means, please share it with them. Thanks for listening and for all that you do. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.